Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. How the One Big Beautiful Bill Act could impact education in Wisconsin. Plus, Representative Derek Van Orden sees his first bill signed into law. And religious groups, including one in Milwaukee, sues the Trump administration over immigration enforcement in churches. All that and more on Rewind Your Week in Review for August 1st. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to another week of Rewind. We spent the last couple of weeks going back and forth, will he, won't he, about Governor Tony Evers. Got the announcement last week, and then this week we learned he was also having a bit of that will I, won't I kind of moment. He said that he wrestled with that decision basically up until the day that he announced.
And that's interesting because there's been this kind of like growing narrative about when did he make the decision? And when did Sarah Rodriguez know? So let's kind of do the background. So July 15th, we got financial reports from the governor showing that he had really not been raising money first half of the year. Okay, the writing was on the wall that he was probably not going to run, though he hadn't said that, made the decision. July 17th, Sarah Rodriguez posted a video on YouTube, private video, announcing a bid for governor. And as she announced last Friday, that video went live. He went, wait a second, why does it say July 17th? Did she get a heads up? And so then the governor says, and then she went up front last weekend on WISN and said, I got a heads up from the governor. Whoa, the mystery deepens. What's going on here? The governor said this week, actually, he was going back and forth the week before he made his decision. Yeah, he told her the same. I told the rest of the cabinet. So, okay, so what's going on here? And this is important. Well, in 6 months from now, not really. But what is important is the way Rodriguez handled this initial kind of question about, well, what did you know? When did you know it? On the one hand, there's been this narrative in conservative media of, oh, this was leaking out earlier. The governor delayed a decision, so we wouldn't look like we were right. He was going to run. On the other, I've gone through and gotten records from the governor's office that shows that, for example, he told his senior staff in the office the day before he announced publicly. He had a meeting the morning of the announcement to tell the cabinet. He taped the video the morning before. I actually have an email that shows he's debating what to wear in the video the night before it actually was taped and then publicly released. So there's that piece of it. With Rodriguez, she kind of gave this air of like, yeah, I got a heads up. Like she would maybe had an inside track. And then she had to backtrack and say, no, I found out what everybody else did. Well, how come you had a video posted July 17th or tape? Well, she got to fumble that question. Her campaign now says she taped two. One to run for governor, one for lieutenant governor. Again, writing was on the wall about the governor. Like it was a surprise he didn't decide to run. She's getting prepared. The campaign's like, this is a good thing. We were prepared for this. Yes, but her answer shows you that she's not really been in the spotlight a lot. Remember, won one term for assembly in 2020. The seat was redrawn to be quite Republican, and the new maps are put in place in 2022. Ran for lieutenant governor, won that two-person primary. It wasn't much of a primary in the end. And she's not really like kind of well-known politically. So for her, this is her first kind of like turn the spotlight. Didn't go great, but the questions become, how does she do raising money, and what's her lane, and how's her message improve? That middle piece, the lane, we talk about this in politics all the time. What is your lane? Well, David Crowley, Milwaukee County Executive, he like put out on Friday almost immediately, I'm taking steps to get in. That means I'm in the race, I just haven't announced yet. Okay, well, there's Crowley, there's Cavalier Johnson, the mayor, and there's former Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, all Milwaukee guys. Perception is that with Crowley more likely running, that Cavalier probably wouldn't run, that Mandela probably has an eye more on running for Congress someday when Gwen Moore retires. So let's give David Crowley, for now, the Milwaukee lane. Senator Kelda Royes, she's seriously considering it, which is often code for, I'm gonna get eventually, or at least explore it. Let's give her the Madison lane, okay, the Dane County lane. What is Sarah's lane? Well, she's from Waukesha, and this is my favorite facts in Wisconsin politics. There are three counties that produce 45% or more of the vote in the Democratic primary every year. What are they?
I'm going to guess Milwaukee, Dane, and I think you've led me to Waukesha.
Yes. Nobody would guess that because it's so big, though. There are a lot of Democrats there. It's a very Republican county. Now it's only like 5.5% versus 19 and 20, so it's not like a big player, but there is a foundation there. Plus, it's a suburban community. Other suburban communities around the state, you can make this pitch. A former nurse, healthcare administrator, consultant, you have a lane to get out there. Can she grasp that lane and really get there? Oh, then there's this one other person, Josh Call, attorney general. Only statewide official looking at running, because Sarah Galuski is now saying she's looking at running for lieutenant governor. Josh Call, you would think, would have an advantage because he's statewide elected official. Now the question is, does he have any name ID, right? Marquette, went back and looked at the Marquette poll, hasn't asked about him since 2019. So, and back then, like, three-fourths of voters didn't know who he was or have an opinion of him. Now that's been some time since then, but we don't know how well he's used that office to raise his profile. In my time covering the Capitol, Jim Doyle is the only JG I covered who really did a good job of using that office to raise his profile. He was really good at it. No offense to J.B. Van Hollen or Brad Schimmel or now Josh Call, but they just aren't been as good at doing it. Maybe it's a time. I think Doyle was AG for 8 or 12 years before he ran for governor. Either way, for Call, it's interesting. His mom, Peg Lautenschlager, former attorney general, was in the assembly from Fond du Lac. Josh went to Stanford Law School. After that, he clerked for a federal judge. He went out to Baltimore as a federal prosecutor. Then moved back to Madison in 2014, I think it was, and worked at Perkins Coie. So he doesn't really have a base where he kind of grew up, but he should have an advantage because of his name ID, because he's been a statewide elected official. And I say should. Of course, we don't really know until this thing kind of progresses. And we don't know if he's actually in yet. We're just waiting for, does he actually pull the trigger on a run for governor?
Well, and with this Rodriguez kind of stumbling moment, let's say, kind of, I think, raises the pros and cons of getting in the race so early. Mm-hmm. One is that she got the spotlight immediately. And then number two is that, you know, she's the only person really being seriously talked about, because everyone else is a probably or a maybe, but not an official yes. And the other thing that kind of comes with that is some of the mudslinging that we're already starting to see. So her campaign put out a statement kind of repudiating claims that her husband is undocumented. She said that these were stories that were being shopped around to journalists. Nobody shopped it over to me, to you either. But this was kind of perhaps being shopped around as Oppo research or something. And she, you know, says that's absolutely not true. Her husband is Mexican-born, naturalized U.S. citizen. But that's also something that goes with the territory of running for office, is those kinds of, you know, people trying to feed stuff to journalists and that kind of
absolutely.
Thing. So that brings us to the other kind of non-news from the governor's race, which is that Scott Walker is not going to be running for the Republican nomination. Last week, when Tony Evers made that announcement, Scott Walker posted some sort of like cryptic messages on Twitter and indicated that maybe he was eyeing being 45 and 47, much like President Donald Trump is 45 and 47. And then over the weekend on Sunday, he released a video saying he's actually not going to run. He's going to keep focusing on his nonprofit that focuses on turning out young conservative voters, and that he'll kind of stay in his lane, but he'll back a common sense conservative.
Okay. Scott Walker probably was never serious about running for governor. That tweet was a picture of a American Maker Gradian hat with the 45-40. Oh, yeah, that's right. 45-47 and interesting. Look, he's making a lot of money with this position. He bought a very nice house once he left the governor's office and got this position. That's not really kind of the trajectory he's been to go back to the governor's office and run again. So he does say every time he's asked, I'm 25 years younger than Joe Biden. I've got plenty of time. But where he's at is a pretty comfortable spot to be. And people I talk to don't think he's really a player for an office like this anytime soon, unless something really changed dramatically. But he wants to stay relevant. I mean, he's on social media constantly, does media interviews. He wants to stay relevant just in case you want that door to open again somewhere down the road.
Well, and again, we have sort of 15 months to be continuing to explore all of this. And so I think some more names will definitely be getting into the field. But sort of looking at the national level, another big story this week, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau put out some memos kind of analyzing how the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the federal budget, could affect certain things here in Wisconsin. And so we will start with their review of Medicaid. Where they found that basically they can't analyze the effect of Medicaid here in Wisconsin just yet, partly because some of the details of implementation requirements will depend upon forthcoming federal guidance, but also because the eligibility and enrollment requirements are new for the program, and so little is known about their actual effects. So kind of break down what they could and couldn't say.
So, yeah, so we have about 181,000 childhood adults right now in the program, and those are the folks who are going to be impacted the most. depending on how the rules are written. Another interesting thing in the memo about this piece of the, and this is, so the Fiscal Bureau does like a post-budget analysis and a string of memos like every 2 years. This is kind of an interesting piece of it because it's intertwined with the budget. And why I'm bringing that up is, we talked about the hospital assessment, right? So the budget was, they raced to get it done to be able to have increase a hospital assessment, basically a tax on patient revenue, that then's put in this formula in Medicaid where you get more federal money in the state. You put most of it toward hospitals, but you keep a chunk for yourself. That program, interesting enough, there's a revision in this memo that talks about, well, we may see that kind of like ratchet down a little bit in future years. I think it's 2028. But there's a kind of formula about what you're paying for services. If you're above a certain rate, you start to lose some of the money. So all the money we're getting right now is okay for this budget. Looks like $918 million plus in additional payments for hospitals, good each year. But down the road, you could see it ratchet down just a little bit. So you gotta watch that.
And so then they also kind of put forward a similar memo about education. This one they were able to, you know, assess a little bit more. And so tell us a little bit about what they were able to tell us about school funding.
So remember, the big pot of school aids in Wisconsin is, general school aids is part of a formula where you have revenue limits. That is a cap on what you spend between state aid and property taxes. The more state aid you put in, the less property tax you can raise in that formula. The state didn't put really anything into general school aids in that formula, in this budget. It said it put into special education, high-cost special education, and mental health services. So Fiscal Bureau did a memo running through every district of like what they can have for spendable revenue in the next two-year period. That includes what they can raise from property taxes. So I think Milwaukee was the biggest at like $150 million between property taxes, special education aid, reimbursable costs, high-cost special education, and mental services. Madison was second, of course, two biggest school districts, right? So that kind of gives you an idea, every district, what they think you're going to get, although the caveat is that's based on enrollment from last year. You need the enrollments coming up to your actual three-year average, get your actual formula, so basically a benchmark of what's going to happen. But it plays into our next topic, which is the other memo on property taxes. So it's interesting, this memo found that projects, it's called the median valued home. It doesn't exist, all right? It's a statewide median valued home. It's a mythical thing. It's an exercise to show what all these policies mean for property taxes on a statewide basis. Well, they're assessed at a local basis, so it's not really like this house worth $290,000, you're gonna see this property tax bump next year, this bill's in December, another one next December. For every district though, if you take that same house at $290,000 and put it in Madison versus Milwaukee versus New Richmond versus Eagle River, it'll all be different because of local factors. That said, overall it shows us that property taxes are going to go up on a statewide basis, more than what the governor had proposed because he had more money for general school aids in his budget. He had incentive for locals to not increase their property tax levies because he'd give you more state money, keep your local levies flat, and other factors. But the increase would be smaller than state law prior to the budget because of other factors that were going into it. You also can't ignore the governor's 400-year veto, because remember, in the last budget, he vetoed language that allowed then an annual increase of $325 per kid per year for four centuries. If you don't put state money into that formula, that increase is paid by property taxes. So that factors into this entire revenue. Either way, more than likely, you're going to see a property tax increase in November, December, and then again next year under this budget.
So definitely continuing to see kind of the ramifications of the federal budget here in Wisconsin. And speaking of other stuff going on in Congress, Representative Derek Van Orden had his first bill signed into law. This is to establish a partial claims program under the Department of Veteran Affairs Home Loan Program. And we have a little bit of video of President Donald Trump introducing this bill, which was passed unanimously by Congress.
An estimated 61,000 American veterans are in danger of losing their homes, as you know. But thanks to this bill, the Department of Veterans Affairs will be empowered to pay loan holders the necessary amount to prevent foreclosures on our veterans so our veterans won't be foreclosed and put out onto the streets. It's very important. This bill also creates a five-year partial claim program that could benefit up to 3.7 million veterans. That's the kind of numbers you're talking about. It's big stuff. The costs of the program are fully offset and will add nothing at all to debt. is common sense legislation that overwhelming support and passed unanimously in the House and the Senate.
So essentially the way that this bill works is it would enable the VA to purchase portions of the money owed by veterans who default or are at risk. It replaces a Biden-era program that was essentially aimed at doing the same thing, but Van Orden has argued that the way that that was structured essentially cost billions of dollars. And as I mentioned, this was passed unanimously, as President Trump mentioned, passed unanimously by Congress.
So the important thing for Van Orden is he's showing he's getting something done, so politically, all right, and try to focus on politics of it, but he's in a swing district. He is going to be targeted next fall. You want to show you're getting things done. So for him, this is progress. He has a very combative, pugnacious reputation on social media. Heard a great phrase this week from an operative. When we are on Twitter or X, we're talking to journalists. We're on Facebook, we're talking to people. So when you're on social media and you're seeing Van Orden and Mark Pocan fight, it's really entertainment for us. But still, he's got this kind of reputation for being this kind of combative person. This is something you go sell in the district. Like, look, I'm getting stuff done to help people in the district. It's good for him.
And, of course, he's a veteran, and veterans are kind of a bipartisanly supported group. So it is the kind of thing that is a slam dunk campaign issue for sure. So then let's move to another kind of federal issue, another lawsuit against the Trump administration. We talk a lot about stuff out of the DOJ, out of Josh Call's DOJ. This one is actually by a national group of religious groups, including one based in Milwaukee. And it is against the Trump administration and the DHS. Over their immigration policy. So 11 different religious groups, including the Milwaukee Lutheran Synod, filed this lawsuit. So for some background, in January, DHS rescinded Biden-era guidelines around where ICE can and can't perform enforcement raids. So technically speaking, they can perform those anywhere, but it gave them guidance around, quote, sensitive areas, so schools and churches. And then this was rescinded in January under the new Trump administration. DHS said, quote, criminals will no longer be able to hide in America's schools and churches to avoid arrest. The Trump administration will not tie the hands of our brave law enforcement and instead trust them to use common sense. So that is in January when they rescinded the guidelines. And so then this lawsuit basically argues that that impinges upon First Amendment religious freedom, that if a person is afraid to go to church because of something that the government might do, that counts as governmental interference in worship, and that also it prevents the churches from being able to sort of minister according to their own values, because if they say they can meet anyone, including perhaps undocumented people, in a house of worship, that impinges on a church's freedom. Of course, the Trump administration says, we still tell our officers to use common sense, and that they are simply, they've tightened the guidance, essentially. So we will see how this lawsuit proceeds. And speaking of lawyers and judges, today we have the long-awaited Susan Crawford investiture ceremony. It's going to take place at 4:30 local today. And just a reminder that people can tune in on WSI to watch this take place. So we had this gazillion-dollar campaign, and she got elected. And so now, many months later, she will officially take the court.
And we're finding out also a new filing from one of Elon Musk's PAC came out about late yesterday afternoon, showed that one of his PACs spent $27 million on petition incentives. I went through this last night, trying to figure out what all it was all about. It doesn't like specify exactly where the money went, all of it, but this PAC ramped up its fundraising February 18th, the day of the primary in Wisconsin, and basically kind of started shutting down end of April, other than the in-kind donations to the group for these inducements, is incentives. So, previously I counted $150 million spent on the race from state documents and TV buys. This is another piece. So, again, I can't say for sure it's all spent in Wisconsin, but sure looks like it. So, it now puts Musk up close to $50 million on this thing. I think he's right about it. So, I had counted $21 million in change with two PACs in Wisconsin through state reports. This $27 million is part of like $40-some million spent overall, the PAC. And then Musk gave $3 million to the Republican Party. So it's safe to say the $115 million I counted probably missed a few million, and somehow this is going to jack the price tag up way higher overall.
Well, I'd be really curious if petition incentives is a line item on any other campaign finance report. I mean, that was such a sort of innovative moment, and it's still being kind of discussed as how sort of technically legal it all was, and so whether he'll try to use that in other races going forward.
Still a lawsuit, Clark. She's doing bribery and trying to challenge his use of the money.
Yeah. So that'll like keep unfolding. So that takes us to the stock reports. Rising this week, we have open records advocates.
So the state Supreme Court in 2022 basically said you have to have a judicial change in the relationship, I think is the phrase, or roughly the phrase, between the parties to get attorney's fees in open records cases. Before, if I sued somebody for records and they voluntarily turned them over after my lawsuit, I could still go get legal fees. Now the court's saying you have to have some kind of change in the court to be eligible. This is a blow for open records advocates saying, look, you can now delay, and right before you go to trial, turn them over and cost me thousands of dollars in legal fees, but get off scot-free. That's not great. Well, the First Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision this week in a lawsuit over Fred Prehn's text messages. So remember, Prehn was appointee of Governor Walker to the Natural Resources Board, served as chair. He stayed on beyond his term expiring of May of 2021. There was a lawsuit about him being on the board, et cetera, et cetera. There's also a lawsuit trying to get his message, you know, his any communications about what's going on. So the court ruled two things. One, it ruled these text messages, they didn't turn over originally, were not private. Like, they were a public record. And two, that Midwest Environmental Advocates could get legal fees in its pursuit of these records. Now, I'll try and make it as easy as possible, but the Supreme Court in 2022 had four members who said you must have a changed relationship to get legal fees. They weren't all four on board with like what the test was to get there. So the first district said, look, we said before there wasn't unanimity or a consensus in this test, so we allowed legal fees in another case. In this one, Judge Everett Mitchell in Dane County, he had found that Prehn was egregious in his delay. There also had been a point where he denied, I think it was a motion for summary judgment, and then the two sides, Prehn and MEA, agreed to a search for records, submitted that agreement to the court, and the court signed off on it. So the first we said, look, that's basically enough to meet this standard. Now, to know for sure if it's enough, you'd have to appeal the state Supreme Court. That court now is a 4-3 liberal majority, so unlikely to uphold the old standard anyway. Two, advocates say, look, if nothing else, we'd prefer to have legislation. There's a bill right now passed the Senate on a voice vote, cleared an assembly committee unanimously, awaiting a vote on the floor, that would set a new standard in statute that they'd prefer than having this kind of like, well, the first court says this, Supreme Court says this, so anyway, a little more definition if they pass that bill and get signed by Governor Evers.
So that brings us to Mix, and that's Sarah Godlewski. We mentioned earlier that she is no longer saying that she wants to run for governor. She is now looking at a run for a lieutenant governor.
Question is why? So now, remember, she was treasurer, ran for U.S. Senate in 2022, dropped out of that primary, got appointed Secretary of State in 2023 when Doug La Follette resigned shortly in his 12th term, and now wants to run for lieutenant governor. I had somebody joke she wants a trifecta of useless offices in Wisconsin. That was this person's terms, not mine. The question, though, is we know Godlewski wants to do something else. I mean, she's got aspirations for higher office. Why would LG be a better platform than Secretary of State? Well, you could argue it's because there's more money in the budget, more staff. I looked. The Secretary of State gets two staffers and $600,000, the lieutenant governor gets five and like 900, something like that. So there's that.
Her office isn't in the basement.
That's a very good point.
Better office space.
Now, the key though is you have to have a willing partner. And in the history of Wisconsin governors, lieutenant governors, has it been great? Scott McCallum and Tommy Thompson weren't close. Barb Lawton and Jim Doyle weren't close. When Scott Walker ran in 2010, his campaign team actually weren't big fans of Rebecca Clayfish, made fun of her actually in emails that came out in a John Doe investigation. But Clayfish stood by him during Act 10, survived her own recall, and they became pretty tight. She became an effective surrogate for him. He was a willing partner. Governor Evers and Mandela Barnes became this kind of like political odd couple, a lot with, you know, the age difference and everything, a background difference. They were got tight. Rodriguez, though, and Evers aren't known being close. Remember, she got elected just 2 years ago with him. So she hasn't really been used effectively, and I'm sure for her mind, by the governor. So for Galuski, let's assume a Democrat wins a governor's office next year. Would he or she use her effectively to give her a better platform than Secretary of State? Because you can do the math of, all right, well, in 2028, Ron Johnson's up. You could run again. Not to suggest she's ambitious, but that's a lot of races. Now, she's not going to be alone, possibly, for the office. Brad Path, state senator, is looking at it. Ryan Sorensen, the 31-year-old mayor of Sheboygan, I've told, is looking at that, and governor. Now, Path is interesting. If he were to run, if he were to win, if he and the governor won in November, he'd have to resign the state Senate seat. Remember, right now, Republicans have 1850 majority in the Senate. There are four seats that are really kind of in play next year. One's held by a Democrat. If Democrats win three of them, any combination of three, they're guaranteed a majority. They sweep all four, they go 18-15. If they're at 17, let's just say they're 17-16, Brad has to resign a swingy seat, and all the marbles for the state Senate is on that special election. Not great for Democrats, right? Again, there's a lot of ifs, but the reason why he might not run. The thing about Galuski worth note is that what your spouse does maybe is not fair in politics, but we're talking politics, right? There's no fair here. Her husband was part of a company that a dozen years ago or so paid a $245 million civil settlement with the federal regulators because they're accused of manipulating markets in New York. Now, again, may not be fair, but that's an issue that could come up and could be baggage for her in a statewide race. It barely was a blip in 2018 frame for state treasurer. It didn't come up when she ran for the U.S. Senate. So could that be a problem? Maybe. But if you look at Galuski, it could be better for her to be lieutenant governor than secretary of state. It could be more fun, for one. And then two, looking at 2028 and 2030, maybe a better platform to run for something else.
And so let's look at falling county revenues.
All right, so I'll hit this quick. We are going to save, state homeowners are going to save $178 million in state taxes on the utility bills, because the state budget says now they're expanding the exemption for utility bills from state sales tax. Great. There's another effect, though. One, counties have a sales tax. They collect it on utility bills, but not anymore. Two, starting in 2023, the state tied share revenue payments to sales tax collections. State collects less than sales tax, that's less than share revenue for the county. So the county is going to take a small hit between one, not collecting sales tax anymore on these utility bills, and two, less money in the pot for shared revenue. So Ford Analytics is an arm of the counties association. It calls it kind of a downstream effect, essentially, for them. But hey, don't forget about us. We lose a little money in this entire deal. While it's good for ratepayers, not great for counties.
Great. Well, and that'll do it for Rewind this week. I am Anivin Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.